Sixth Grade Conference, Lecture 62, The First Crusade. We need to think again of the Emperor Constantine and his mother, who single-handedly determined that Jerusalem was a holy city to Christians, that the place where Jesus was crucified, where he was buried, the path from one place to the other, the streets on which he walked with his cross, that all of this was sacred and holy, and a place that Christians should try to experience in the course of their lifetime, should make pilgrimages there. Now, there's nothing wrong with all of that. However, it is also part of the materialization of Christianity, for which Constantine can be held quite responsible. He did what was really in harmony with Rome. He did what was in a certain way necessary for the increasing materiality which had to be part and parcel of Western culture. But by making that city holy, rather than recognizing that the deed of Christ transcended any geographical location, it made, we might say, the whole earth holy, and no one need take a pilgrimage there, instead making it site-specific and connecting it with territory, with land. It was convenient, of course, that Jerusalem happened to be in Judea, and Judea happened to be a Roman province, although not always one that easily gave in to the rule of Rome. So Constantine was able to do this, and because of the incredible Roman roads and the Roman navy in his lifetime, it was a safe and relatively fast trip for wealthy pilgrims to take. So this, of course, led later on to difficulties. After the rise of Islam and the remarkable rapid conquests that Islamic soldiers made in one place after another, Jerusalem then fell into the hands of the Saracens. And the Saracens proved themselves, by and large, to be extremely open and tolerant to the Jews, for whom Jerusalem was already a holy city, and to the Christians who continued their pilgrimages there. So during the period of time that the Saracens were the representatives of Islam in that part of the world, things generally went fairly well. In fact, the Saracens realized that there was profit to be made, that we'd say today it was a tourist destination. And by selling food at a higher price, by providing accommodations at a high price, they were able to profit greatly from the piety of the Christians who came their way. But then things changed, because it was at this point, and now we're speaking about, you know, several hundred years, that the Seljukian Turks became the most active and most aggressive group in Islam, and they took over for the Saracens. So just as in Europe, where there were these divisions between tribes, there were also divisions in Islam. And when the Seljukians became the dominant force, that changed the nature of Islam quite a bit, and it certainly changed the nature of life in Jerusalem. And after this, Christians found themselves increasingly hindered in their movements to and out of and around Jerusalem, charged ever greater duties and levies on trying to get there at all. And finally, those who stayed on to try to bring some form and order into the pilgrimages into Jerusalem, they found themselves persecuted, even killed. And it was said that there was outright slaughter of men, women, and children by the Turks. Nonetheless, the Christians generally accepted this. It was just part of the suffering that went along with the pilgrimage to this holy place. But as it happened, at the turn of the first millennium, Peter the Hermit, who was somewhat of a failure in his life, one who found that it was hard for him to be a truly social being, so he decided to choose a holy life instead of the more secular one he had been living. He made his way to Jerusalem and experienced firsthand the suffering, the oppression, the chaos that was the lot of the Christian pilgrim to Jerusalem. And he saw Simeon, an old distinguished churchman who tried to work with the Turks and tried to make things more equitable for the Christians, but was too old and too weak and failed. And so Peter was deeply touched by this. And when he went to the Church of the Sepulchre, one of the holy places that Constantine had built up years before, there he received divine inspiration, so he felt, to find a way to improve the lot of the Christians in Jerusalem. And so he went to Simeon and said, "I am returning to France, but I promise you, I will come back and I will have Western troops with me, and we will win this city back for Christendom." And so he went back. He managed to find his way to the Pope, who himself was an individual of great charisma, eloquence, and Peter convinced the Pope that he had a divine mission to free Jerusalem from the oppressive hand of the Turks. And he convinced the Pope of this. The Pope himself sent Peter throughout Europe. He gave him this task. And Peter would often appear on the back of a donkey, holding a large cross in his hand, barefoot, wearing a coarse mantle. And he convinced people. He had people listen to the fact that this was needed. This had to be done. The Holy Land had to be freed. And Pope Urban II himself tried to convince noblemen that they should go along, that they should raise up an army. At first, the response was rather lukewarm. And then Urban thought, if I go to France, the Franks, remember Clovis, the Franks are an aggressive group. And they're hot-tempered. And right now, things have been fairly peaceful within Europe. They're looking for something to do. This martial spirit, we might say the Norse spirit, still lives strongly there. So he called a council at Clermont in France. This was 1095, right at the end of this beginning of the new millennium. And huge numbers came, and both Urban and Peter spoke, each one of them more powerful, more fiery than the last, describing what had gone on in Jerusalem, the horrors which the Turks were guilty, and the suffering of Jesus to see that his own homeland, his own holy places, were being desecrated by the hands of the infidels. And the Pope already had prepared little crosses made of silk and cotton, red crosses, and he had the thousands, tens of thousands of people who were gathered there kneel. And whoever said that he or she would go to the Holy Land and free it from the infidels would receive one of these crosses. And so from the word cross came the term crusader. Who was it who went with Peter on this original sortie? Well, although the noblemen and some of the finest knights of Europe agreed to go, they knew it took time to raise an army. They had to return to their castles. They had to convince their vassals that this was a worthy task. They had to get their supplies, make sure that weapons were made, that there was sufficient armor and horses. This would take at least a year, but there was already incredible enthusiasm for this. We could say that in a certain respect, Urban and Peter demonstrated in the way that Cato in the Roman Senate had long before demonstrated the value of advertising and repetition of the same thing. Peter and Urban certainly did this. They followed in Cato's footsteps. But beyond that, they brought incredible passion, incredible feeling to what they did. And they painted an enemy who was nearly demonic, about whom nothing good whatsoever could be said, who had to be obliterated, destroyed. We could say that here we see, at the dawn of the second millennium, the beginning of propaganda. This was a real propaganda fest, this Council of Clermont. And it was effective. It worked. And what happened, that people of all classes flocked to Peter, begging him to march with them at once. They did not want to wait for the regular army. Their passion was raised. They were going to leave everything and go with him. So, not knowing any better himself, he set out, and he had a knight friend who had joined forces with him named Walter the Penniless. And Walter the Penniless was literally that, whether he had lost all of his inherited money or given it up for higher purposes, we don't know. But he said, as a knight, he would command the people. They led an army of about 80,000 people, men, women, and children, many of them, the great majority of them, of the peasant class. So this was often called the Peasants' Crusade. They were people of an extremely dreamy to sleepy consciousness. Peasants, indeed, one might wonder, well, how did they get away from their land? Well, of course, their lords and ladies were allowing them to do this. Some left without permission. But as it happened, at the time of year that they set out, there was not much going on in the great lands around the castles. And the peasants, for a good part of the winter, we imagine them leading lives that were nasty, brutish, and short, and slaving away for their horribly cruel leaders. It wasn't really that simple at all. Actually, the peasants spent a good deal of the winter fast asleep. They literally hibernated, three or four or more, sleeping together in a bed, getting up only to relieve themselves once in a while, and eating very little. That was their consciousness. They were still in a state of dormancy, of hibernation, awaiting the time that they would awaken. And this was it. This was like the great awakening of the consciousness of the peasant class. And now they were going, for the first time in their lives, to go more than 1 or 2 miles away from their home. And it was incredibly exciting and inspiring. It was a great adventure. And we could say that the group that followed Peter the Hermit and Walter the Penniless were also a perfect rabble. Men took their whole families in their ox carts. They didn't take much food with them, and weapons, well, whatever they could find. And they, of course, had no idea of distance or geography. Sixth graders, that's why it's important to learn geography. Anytime they would see any kind of building, whether it was a castle or a town, they would think that was Jerusalem, and they'd get ready to fight. And of course, they had to go a long, long way from France to Jerusalem. Peter himself, though an eloquent preacher and a master propagandist, had no idea about military command. He had been a hermit, and now he had 80,000 people walking behind him, waiting for him and his friend Walter to command them. And finally, the people wouldn't listen to him at all. They could see he didn't know what he was doing. So it was complete chaos. But somehow this mass of humanity made its way across Europe and found its way towards the different lands surrounding the Holy Land. They got into fights with the natives of these lands because they were stealing food from their farms. They were treading over their fields, they were drinking up their lakes, and the Turks finally surprised them in battle. And the figures aren't clear, of course, but probably more than 70,000 of these people died either along the way or in that horrendous battle with the Turks. Peter somehow escaped. And he remained then in the vicinity of Jerusalem, and he waited for the real army of the First Crusade, which was led by incredibly effective knights and military commanders. There were a huge number of men on horseback. The army was probably more than 100,000, only about 25,000-30,000 actually made their way to Jerusalem, but they were well-armed, they were well-trained, they were disciplined, and they defeated the Turks. They captured the holy city. And Godfrey, their principal leader, was offered a golden crown, but he refused to wear one in the city where his lord had worn a crown of thorns. Instead, he asked for the title of Defender of the Holy Sepulchre. And now Peter was called the Apostle of the First Crusade. He preached to the Crusaders from the Mount of Olives. They fell on their knees before him, and he accomplished what he had set out to do. He asked nothing for himself. He returned to his monastery in France, and there he led a life of prayer and died peacefully. So the First Crusade had ended. The Christian troops, much to some degree to their own surprise, had won the city of Jerusalem, and now it was Christian once again. And this is where we will end this first eventful millennium of Christianity, this extension of Roman might, Roman aggression, Roman occupation, but also this striving for the good, this wish to change the world in a certain way. All of these things live there so strongly, with so much ambivalence, so much turmoil, this sense that a new people now are on the earth, and something from the future is trying to touch them, stream towards them. How prefiguring of what it is to be a sixth grader, a 12-and-a-half-year-old today. How beautifully the history that the children learn in this year meets them on one level of perhaps the karma that they carry into this incarnation, but also a sense of mission, a sense of looking towards the future, which they can also experience, particularly in these stories of the Middle Ages. So with my class, we left everything there. The Christians are in Jerusalem. All's right with the world, knowing that we would begin the next year with the Third Crusade and all that resulted from that, particularly the destiny then of Richard the Lionheart and his brother John, his mother Eleanor of Aquitaine, France, England, but that is a different story, and we'll take that up in next year's conference.